The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. It is Friday, the end of a week. We're in the middle of the month of April. I'm really looking forward to this program for a number of reasons. And if you just tuned in, by all means, go to Rents.com, look under Harry Cooper's name where it says photos, and download the pictures, or at least access them, so you'll be able to follow along as we take this remarkable trip over the next couple of hours or so. We are going on a trip back in time to try to solve one of the most controversial questions of our time, or all time for that matter, and it is, quite simply put, what really happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun and other highest level members of the German government at the end of World War II. Our guide this evening is the remarkable Harry Cooper, founder and director of the world's second largest German U-boat history organization, which contains and presents to members and others alike not only books and DVDs, but a complete U-boat history, in-depth stories by U-boat skippers, history of the U-boats from the skippers themselves, U-boat officers and U-boat crews, also profiles of submarines and U-boat World War II veterans. We've done several programs with Harry. They are extraordinary, and they're in the archives, and I hope you'll all be able to listen to them. Tonight, we're going to shake some folks up. I guess it could be said that Adolf Hitler is arguably the most famous or infamous, however you will, political leader in history. Now, I didn't say the most famous man in history. I said the most famous or infamous political leader in history. He is, of course, continually vilified by the World Zionist Press, which is the game. But in vilifying the man, they continue to keep his name up there at the top of the list. It is really an extraordinary situation. We could talk for hours about the political aspects of it, the social impact of what Germany attempted to do after World War I on the hideous Treaty of Versailles. But let's right now say hello to Harry Cooper. Harry, welcome back. I'm really glad to have you on tonight. I'm looking forward to this very much.
Good to be back on, Jeff.
Adolf Hitler, the most famous political figure in history?
One of the most. Julius Caesar would be another one. But of the 20th century, no question. I believe it's been said there's more books written about Adolf Hitler than all the other world leaders put together in the 20th century.
I wouldn't be surprised. Adolf Hitler, born April 20th.
1898.
That's tomorrow.
No, 89, I'm sorry.
1889, yeah, tomorrow.
And you know what else is tomorrow's birthday? The 113th birthday of the United States Navy Submarine Service.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a complicated thing, celebrating both birthdays on the same day.
Well, at your wonderful organization, which is called, as most of you know, Shark Hunters International Incorporated, and the website is sharkhunters.com, you certainly celebrate and honor U-boat crews from both sides of the fence in World War II and in World War I, for that matter.
Right, yeah. Our motto is yesterday's enemies are today's friends. And when we have our conventions, of course, they're getting kind of thin on the veterans now, but when we have our conventions, the guys that sit there and they'd drink together and they'd sing together and they realized they weren't different at all. They just wore different uniforms.
And had different ideologies.
The fighting man didn't have much of an ideology. He just served his country, like I did. I joined the Air Force. I wanted to kill communists because that's an end to the Soviet Union, and I met some of them, and they were the same as me. They just wanted to raise their children in peace,
right,
and not get a war again.
Well, the ideological game is what divides people, and that was my point.
Oh, yeah. Well, it divides nations because of the leadership.
And it's ultimately a game to the banksters who profit by financing both sides of all wars, and they literally feed on the blood and grief and money and loot of wars. That's who these people are.
Yeah, here's a point which, of course, has nothing to do with tonight's subject, but when the Germans were bombing England in the Battle of Britain, they got their fuel from Standard Oil, which is today called Exxon, and when the RAF went up to shoot them down, they got their fuel from Standard Oil, and when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, they got their fuel from Standard Oil, and the Ploesti oil field raids come into their $23 million in gold.
Uh-huh.
But that's another whole topic.
Yeah, well, we could talk for weeks about this. I had
I've been
a story
doing it for 30 years.
Yeah. I had a story yesterday, the real story of World War II, which is unknown to probably 95% of the people who are walking and talking on this planet. So successful has been the rewriting and revision of history ever since the war ended and during the war by the controllers. And I think most of you folks know who the controllers are. Let me do just a little bit of background on Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow's his birthday. Makes this program rather propitious. Born April 20th, 1889. Died, allegedly, April 30th, 1949, or 5. He was an Austrian-born German politician. We have younger folks here in the audience.
Right.
And the leader of the Nazi Party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. He was Chancellor of Germany from 1933 to 1945 and dictator of Nazi Germany as Führer from 1934 to 1945. Adolf Hitler was at the center of Nazi Germany, World War II in Europe, and the Holocaust, whatever in fact that really was. Hitler was a decorated veteran of World War I. He joined the German Workers' Party. And that was in 1919, and became leader of the NSDAP in 1921. In 1923, he attempted a coup d'etat in Munich, known as the Beer Hall Putsch. The failed coup resulted in Hitler's imprisonment, during which time he wrote his memoir, Mein Kampf, My Struggle. After his release in 1924, Hitler gained popular support by attacking the hideous Treaty of Versailles. And if you ever want to read something of an historical nature that is unjust and outrageous and guaranteed World War II, just read about the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah, it was tremendously horrible.
He also promoted, I'm reading from Wikipedia here, pan-Germanism and other things as well. After his appointment as Chancellor in 1933, he transformed the Weimar Republic into the Third Reich, a single-party dictatorship based on the totalitarian and autocratic ideology of Nazism. Hitler's aim was to establish a new order of absolute Nazi German hegemony in continental Europe. To this end, his foreign and domestic policies had the aim of seizing Lebensraum, living space, for the German people. He directed the rearmament of Germany and the invasion of Poland by the Wehrmacht in September 1939, resulting in the outbreak of World War II in Europe. Under Hitler's rule, in 1941, German forces and their European allies occupied most of Europe and North Africa. In 1943, Germany had been forced onto the defensive and suffered a series of escalating defeats. In the final days of the war during the Battle of Berlin in 1945, Hitler married his longtime partner, Eva Braun. On 30 April 1945, less than 2 days later, the two committed suicide to avoid capture by the Red Army, and their corpses were burned. Now, you and I would write that a lot differently, but that's the formal Wikipedia entree into studying.
Yeah, that's the fictitious version of history there. Notice they liberally sprinkle the word Nazi in there because that's supposed to...
It's obligatory. You have to do that.
Yeah, I know that.
So,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What they forgot to mention was why Hitler sent the Wehrmacht into Poland on the 1st of September, 1939, which incidentally was the day my mother went into labor because I was born the next day. you know, what did he wake up and his cable wasn't working and he figured, well, let's go invade Poland? No, for about 2 weeks prior to that invasion, the Polish authorities had forcibly thrown almost 500,000 ethnic Germans out of the Danzig corridor, and about 49,000 ethnic Germans were hacked to death, beaten to death by Polish authorities, etc. And that's why the war started.
The pressure on Hitler to go to the rescue of the German people in Poland was clearly overwhelming.
Exactly.
He did what he had to do. You mentioned something that nobody knows about. And essentially, 50,000 Germans were slaughtered by Poles. The Poles to this day, to their everlasting shame, won't talk about that.
Right, there's tons of photos about
tons
it.
Tons of photos.
And it's been documented.
Very well so. Okay, we're going to take a break and come right back with Harry Cooper. And I urge all of you again to go to photos under Harry's name at rents.com. Load the pictures up. We've got a lot to go through, and we're going to get started in just a couple minutes. Okay, welcome back. Talking to Harry Cooper about Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun and others who were in the bunker in the final days of the Battle of Berlin, when the Red Hordes were literally encircling and penetrating to the city center. This is an amazing story that we could talk probably for 6 or 8 hours about. We're going to try and put it into a couple of hours for you. Lots of pictures.
Week.
Yeah, oh, easy. The film The Bunker was, I guess, the latest version to cement the story as it has been constructed by the victors, if they were victorious in the war. Go ahead, Harry. Let's set this up.
Okay. Your listeners are going to get a full PhD course in a couple of hours. They should have paper and pencil or pen and paper to jot down whatever notes, and should refer to that photo array that that your webmaster put together. It will walk your listeners through step by step by step. We've published quite a few books with shark hunters, but there's two of them that pertain to this particular topic. The first one, as you see in photo number one there, is the book called Escape from the Bunker. And that basically is a letter that I received from one of our members, Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco, who was a Spaniard working for the Germans as a spy. He wasn't a very good spy. His first big task was to lure the deposed King of England, Edward VIII, who was later the Duke of Windsor, to lure him out of Portugal into Spain on a hunting trip so the SS could grab him and then play let's make a deal with England. Well, he fizzled on that. And in the late part of the war, the last few months, he was based in the bunker. And this letter he sent was 114 pages long, typewritten, single-spaced. So it was one hell of a letter.
Wow.
Yeah. And in the letter, which is the book, he describes how the war was going. He tells about how everything was going in the Führer bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And he does explain that he saw Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann and removed from the bunker. Hitler was in horrible health, and he was ready to die there with the people, but Bormann wanted to keep the Reich alive, the movement, which he did, as we'll talk about, and he needed the figurehead. So Don Angel saw Hitler and Eva Braun forcibly drugged and removed from the bunker.
There had to be others there who saw this as well. But they're not talking necessarily, of course.
Well, there's one more. We'll talk about him later in it. But most of those people are dead. Most of them got killed very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember in the news, 10 or so years ago, some independent forensic pathologist who had no axe to grind was allowed to examine the skull fragment in the Red Army Museum.
Right.
And he found that it belonged to a young woman, a woman in her like 20s. So
I remember the story.
Right. So that obviously was not Hitler, and we know it wasn't Hitler. So the first book escape from the bunker, tells exactly what went on prior to the departure and how he got to Argentina. The second book shown there, which is photo two, The Secret Alliance by Michael Ivanheim, he explains how it was possible for all this to happen because Argentina and Germany had been buddies, even though Argentina finally had to declare war against Germany under incredible pressure from the United States. I think it was only a couple of weeks before the war ended they finally declared war against Germany, but it was just on paper, more or less. And in this, in the second book, The Secret Alliance, he talks about the two submarines that surrendered in Argentina months after the war ended. And the last one to surrender was U-977 under Heinz Schaefer, which was a Type 7C, which had a 6,000-mile radius. He left his base in Norway with only three-quarters of a fuel load, went down to his combat station off England,
mm-hmm.
got the surrender order, went back to Norway, dropped off the married people, and they didn't need combat troops anymore. He filled the inside of the sub with a lot of special equipment and headed for South America.
What kind of special equipment, Harry, do we know?
We're not sure yet, but it's described in that book, The Secret Alliance.
Okay.
High-tech stuff, and we'll get into that later on in this thing.
Let me ask you if we can rewind a little bit.
Rewind.
Everybody has heard the story of how Hitler and Eva Braun died, and their mm-hmm. bodies were carried out, thrown mm-hmm. into a shallow pit. Petroleum was, gasoline apparently was thrown on their bodies, and the bodies were burned.
Uh-huh.
And that's the most commonly known story about the end of Hitler and Braun.
Yeah, right.
Now, when the pictures, and there were a couple pictures taken of the alleged dead Hitler began circulating on the net, people thought that, well, there he is.
Yeah.
He's got a bullet hole in his forehead. He's dead. But if you look at the face, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that's not the same guy.
Exactly.
Hitler had body doubles. Churchill had several that we know about. They all did.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's very simple to understand that a body double is sacrificed to give a cover.
Mm-hmm.
A child could figure that out. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to touch on that just for a moment.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Well, and by some accounts, he shot himself in the forehead. By some accounts, he shot himself in the temple.
Temple, yes.
And I even read one account where he put the pistol in his mouth and bit down on a cyanide cap at the same time he pulled the trigger. Now, how anybody can bite down on anything with a pistol barrel in your mouth, it's kind of hard to imagine. But
he was very versatile.
Yeah. Then I think, if I remember correctly, they did some testing on the blood stains on the sofa. And it wasn't his type, et cetera. So it's a dandy little hoax.
Exactly. Okay, very good. All right, stand by, folks. We'll take a break. Come right back with Harry Cooper as we roll back the mists and look at history as it very likely really happened. We'll leave it up to you to make your own decision, of course, as we always do. But this is a remarkable story. Stay tuned. There is some famous footage taken of Hitler in the last days outside the bunker. I guess he was walking up a line of young boys who were going out to sacrifice themselves against the advancing communist hordes.
Yep.
And if you look at those images and accept that as being Adolf Hitler, you'll have to also come up to the conclusion that he was about 5'4". That his face was massively bloated and his nose was different. That's the way I see it, Harry.
5'4"? Okay.
If you look at him next to the little, the young man, he was not towering over them. Let's put it that way.
He was kind of hunched over too, as I recall. I don't have that photo in front of me, but I've seen it a zillion times.
Yeah. Anyway, it's hard to know when and if the body double was used in public, but we do believe that that's what was presented as the corpse.
The doppelganger.
Correct. All right. Now,
I'll get off the this particular book here quickly, because otherwise we'll be here until dawn. But there's one quote in the book there. It says, "We shall never forget nor be able to repay the immense debt of gratitude we owe to our comrades of the German army." And that was in a speech by Juan Perón on the 4th of April, 1952.
In Argentina. Very interesting.
Yes. Now, these books are both available at Shark Hunters. Just go to sharkhunters.com and click on books. Now, if you go down to photo 3, that's Don Angel.
He was a young
Spanish operative.
Uh-huh.
And then photo 4 is a German Abwehr agent who's still alive, good friend of mine. He confirmed that Don Angel was indeed the spy he said he was. And we maybe talk about Peter later on. But who said that Hitler was not dead in the Führer bunker? This is people right after the war. President Truman asked Stalin at Potsdam if Hitler was dead. Stalin simply said no. After a long and thorough investigation, Field Marshal Zhukov told Stalin, "We have found no corpse that could be Hitler's." 12th of October, 1945, General Beadle Smith, Eisenhower's chief of staff, said, "No human being can conclusively say that Hitler's dead."
What date was that, that Beadle Smith made that remark?
12th of October, 45.
All right, that's a ways after April 30th. All right.
And there's a few of them here, but here's one more. Colonel Hamlich, the chief of intelligence in Berlin, was charged with determining what happened to Hitler. And after a thorough investigation, he said, "There is no evidence beyond that of hearsay to support the theory of Hitler's suicide. On the basis of present evidence, no insurance company in America would pay a claim on Adolf Hitler." So, and there's others. Even Eisenhower in 1952 said, "We've been unable to unearth one bit of tangible evidence of Hitler's death." So, let's move to photo 5. This is just one of the many, many, many files. One of our agents, we call them SEIG agents, S-E-I-G, means Shark Hunters, Eagle Hunters Intelligence Group. And some of them are better than professional spies, and some of them are professional spies.
All right, this is an FBI letter, slightly redacted.
Right, right. Well, yeah, they redacted it before they gave it to us. Mm-hmm. But this one agent, we call him Tauker, he has sent us literally thousands of pages of files from the FBI and the CIA, which was OSS at that time. Not all of them conclusive about Hitler, some were about other people, but this one is September of 1944, and they already are talking about Hitler running off to Argentina when the war was over. So they knew he was going to go there. Now let's move to photo number 6. Now, if anybody saw the movie Das Boot, incidentally, it's not Das Boot. They didn't make a movie about shoes. Das Boot, B-O-O-T, is boat in German, and it means boat. You see down at the bottom of photo 6, the city of Vigo,
yes.
Spain. Uh-huh. Remember in the movie Das Boot, there was a German supply ship in the harbor, and the submarine came up alongside it, et cetera, et cetera, and they got showers and fresh. Well, they did have ships in the harbor in Vigo. After the war was over, the town of Villa Garcia, way up at the top of that estuary, is where most of the tramp steamers and black boats, the submarines that didn't exist, that's where they took off for what the Allies called the rat line for high-ranking and not-so-high-ranking Germans getting out of Europe and going down to Argentina.
Hmm.
We're going to follow that.
This is after the cessation of hostilities?
Yes, yes. And it went all the way to the middle of 1947, which was 2 years after the war.
Obviously, this was known by the Allies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Number seven. Here's a German commander. His rank was Oberleutnant, which is like full lieutenant, and he's got his Knight's Cross. His name is Heinrich Garbers. Who the heck is he? What did he win that Knight's Cross for? Scroll down to photo number eight, a beat-up old sailboat. He was running supply missions down to Argentina all through the war with the sailboat because wood doesn't show up on radar.
He sailed that boat all the way from Europe to Argentina?
Several times. Several times. Oh, hey, I got a 30-foot sailboat. I've sailed long distances in it.
Mm-hmm.
People now are sailing around the world almost in bathtubs. But he was using this yawl, the yawl-rigged sailing ship. He was bringing people, money, supplies into Argentina, taking other things back out. And toward the end of the war, he was talking with Bormann at a reception, and Bormann asked him if it would be easy to get ships or boats into this secret area in Argentina, and Garbers told him, yeah, no problem. So scroll on down to item nine now.
Okay.
And you'll see the red arrow, and it points to, it goes through Golfo San Matias, and there's a little tiny cove up there called Caleta de los Loros, which is Parrot Bay, in the town of San Antonio Oeste. You'll notice the black line that goes left, and then it goes right and up. That's the rail line. And in that town of San Antonio Oeste was major spy headquarters for the Reich in the Lahousen Wool Company headquarters. They were owned by General Lahousen, who was a spy. Well, he was an agent of sorts.
All right.
And so this is where these guys were coming in most of the time. There were a few other spots, but this was their major spot. Remember that Parrot Bay, because it gets important later. Okay, so they're coming down from Spain to Argentina. It's a long way. Where do we stop to pick up food? There's no Walmart. So has anybody ever heard of the island of Trinidad? Not Trinidad, where a bunch of happy people are beating on steel drums and drinking rum and Coca-Cola. This is an island, Trinidad, that's photo 10. It's in the middle of nowhere in the South Atlantic, about 1,000 kilometers off Rio de Janeiro. It's owned by Brazil, and Brazil has a small naval contingent there, right where that red X is. And, you know, about two dozen people. They've owned the island forever, and every morning they hoist the flag to say, we own 200 miles of fishing around here, and every evening they retire the colors. And that was it.
It's 1,000 miles away from Rio?
1,000 kilometers.
All right.
That's about, what, 650, 700 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can only get to this island with the permission of the Brazilian government and with the help of the Brazilian Navy, and they took me out there. They were just fantastic. Very helpful. So,
what was the pretext of your request to be taken out there to gain access to it?
I told them I wanted to find out, you know, look for evidence that the Germans were there during
the
war. Which they were. In March of 1939, all of a sudden, the Brazilians just pulled their troops off the island. And about 1 week later, we're down to item number 11. 1 week later, the 1939 Schwabenland expedition arrived off their shore. Now, they obviously didn't make it from Germany to this island in 1 week,
in
so they had
week,
been offshore.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they came, and they had the catapult ships, and they would catapult a couple Dornier whales before they went on down to Antarctica. Now, we look at photo 11, and then photo 12, sorry. That was the view in 1939, and I put an arrow to that pinnacle.
Okay.
Because there's that same photo, the same pinnacle that I took off the deck of that ship as we pulled into the roadstead. If you look down at the lower left-hand part of the photo, you see small buildings there.
All right, now let me back up. Number 12 is a photo wartime or
1939.
Closer. All right, before the war,
yeah.
Just at the beginning of the war. And
a couple months before.
Photo 13 is the picture you took showing the very same.
A couple years ago.
All right, very good.
Now, on 13, I didn't circle it in red because I thought about it later. If you look down below the three, you'll see a diagonal ridge coming down.
Sure.
Okay.
Heading off to the right.
That's correct. We're going to show you pictures in a little bit where the Germans built a radio tower there. Let's scroll down to number 14. That just shows the pinnacle. And this is Landplatz, 18th of March, 1939, with 12 men came ashore on the island of Trindade.
Mm-hmm.
I can't read the rest of it, but you can see the buildings there. They're barracks and little shacky places. And photo 15 gives you a better look at it. Now we roll to number 16.
Okay, again, this is a wartime or pre-wartime picture of those dark objects at the bottom of photo 14.
Yeah, those are the huts that had been there since the beginning of the 20th century because they had fishermen there and also, like I say, the Brazilian Navy to raise the flag to show they own 200 miles of fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at number 16, where that arrow is, that says 18 and 19th of March 1939 on Trindade Island, Südostseite, that's the southeast. Lager 2 is Camp 2.
Okay.
And the height is 244 meters. And if you look closely there and also at photo 17, you can see the building that was there. And you see it where those little arrows are pointing at number 17.
Sure. Now, that is that diagonal ridge we're looking at.
That's correct.
Okay. So we're right on top of that, near the top, and we can see a little structure of some kind there.
Right, and they built I think it was 80-meter-high radio antenna. This was one of the two radio towers they built there.
Mm-hmm.
And it says Geheim Reichstag, which means secret Reich affairs, and then Geheim Kommandantensache means secret for the commander's affairs, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's where this thing was built. This was the northern one on the southeast corner. Now, here's the photo, 18, I shot from the front porch of the visitor's building, which was kind of rustic. And you can see the arrows pointing at a cross. That's where the cemetery had been for the Brazilian sailors. And if you scroll up now to number 19, there's a better shot of that,
mm-hmm.
where the cemetery had been. And then the red line, that was that ridge. A lot of the stuff on the ridge and also the cemetery was totally washed away in heavy weather. So this is all we have to look at. So then starting with photo 20 is that same ridge that I took that photo on the opposite side of the ridge.
Got it looking back, okay.
Right. Then we go down to photo
21. And that's, we can see you're looking up the ridge.
Yeah, this is the other
uphill.
Direction now.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking to the south. The other one was looking to the north. This is, we're on our way to the other radio tower. And I'm standing in behind the visitor's barracks. And all we have to do is go up that saddleback and around that promontory there in photo 21. But once you get around that promontory in 22, you got to go over a field, up another ridge, and in between two more outcroppings. And then in photo 23, you have to go all the way up another ridge and up another outcropping to where that red arrow is, photo 24. That's me about 2,000 feet up.
That's a workout. That's really a walk. Wow.
Oh, we're just getting started here, Jeff. We're just getting started. And now remember, they removed all the goats from the island. They used to have goats there because that's what, when the ships had come down to run to South America, they had herds of goats and pigs and sea turtles. Now the goats are removed, so you got sawgrass knee high, and the ground is either sand or little pebbles. So every time you take a step, you're sliding back. And, oh boy, it's tough. So here we are about 2,000 feet up. Now we have to go number 25, down another valley and up over another ridge.
Okay, I'm still at 24 here.
Oh, okay.
We didn't get to 24. We don't want to skip that. There's a cross there.
24, yeah, that's a grotto, 2,000 feet up. And
a cave behind it of some kind.
That's correct. And there's just little mementos of the various Brazilian Navy ships that put in there. But, boy, you got to want to go there. It's a tough hike. And as you see by the picture, I'm an old fart. Then we go down to 25, and we're still proceeding southerly toward the other radio station, radio building.
Were you walking this by yourself, or did you have a guide?
There was one guy with me, a younger guy. He spoke English. And I didn't know why he kept staying with me until finally I asked him. Turns out he was the Navy doctor assigned to the island, and they figure if the old guy fell over with a heart attack, he could help me out.
That was nice of him. All right, okay.
That was nice. So then we went 26. Down
25
another,
takes you up and over. 26, you're coming down.
Yeah, 27 across a valley. Through the sand, there's a whole bunch of seabirds that didn't like us being there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go to 28, down that next saddleback. Ah, but look what we're about to find. And
looks like concrete 20, to me.
And go to 29.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
Aha. Uh-huh.
A structure.
And way, way out there on the left side, that's our ship. That's an LST. That's a 700-foot-long LST. And it looks kind of tiny from way up here.
Hmm.
So roll up to number 30, just a little shacky thing.
That's now, the little shacky thing was built by the Germans.
We believe so.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to photo set number 2 now.
Okay, we're at number 30 here, showing you outside the entryway.
Truck.
Yeah,
that's right.
Now, would this shack have been manned around the clock?
I would assume so. There's no reason you would build a radio station and leave it empty.
Yeah, okay.
My guess, and that's all it is right now, my guess is this was to communicate with the expedition they sent down to the Antarctic and also with the raiders. But that's just my theory.
Right.
Then we roll up to 31. This was the second time I was here, incidentally. The first time I had the island doctor with me. The second time they sent me with this guy, who is a Brazilian Navy SEAL. Tough guy. Geez, that guy never quit. He was about one-third my age, so. Now, further down the island, as you see in number 32.
In number 31, we see two pieces of a building.
Those were the antenna support.
Okay.
The steel has either been removed for scrap or just rusted away. The salt air is not very pleasant on steel.
Mm-hmm. All right, number 32.
32. This is an old photo taken in the 1930s. They're down at the very southeastern tip of the island. There's a cave that goes right through the island. As you see, it's tall enough to put small ships into, submarines. We don't know if they ever used it for that. I was going to go there. And the next picture, 33,
It goes all the way through the island, that cave?
All the way through the island, comes out the other side.
Now there's the hole.
Yep. And in 33, that's as close as I could get. There's a little rim, kind of like almost like a sidewalk, but it's, you know, natural. It goes all around that curve and to the cave.
Depends on the tide,
unfortunately, it was only about 1 foot above sea level at high tide. And the day we were there, there was a pretty big surge running. And about every fifth or sixth wave would be like 6 feet high. And so anybody walking on that little rimway
washed
there,
away.
Yeah, they'd be on their way to Africa.
So all right, so that hole, that cave,
yeah,
you believe could have accepted a submarine?
It had the size. Whether they did it or not, we haven't found out yet. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to get a small boat and go in there.
All right.
I was thinking about scuba diving into there, but one of my hosts said that that has been tried before, and every single scuba diver who has ever gone in died in the cave. So I figured, well, let's not tempt fate. We'll go in a boat.
I agree with you.
Yeah. So we go down number 34. For whatever reason, the Germans just up and left in 1941. And the Brazilians came back, and this is their little plaque to show that they came back. And we still don't know why the Germans left and the Brazilians came back at that time.
Anything to do with the conclusion of their Antarctic expedition?
I don't know, but I'm thinking it's because they didn't need the radio towers anymore. That's just my my theories.
Right.
But at 1941, they were gone. So let's roll down to number 35 here. That's a map of the part of Argentina we deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, you see where the number one, the yellow arrow and circle, that's Golfo San Matias, which we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And the rail line, you see the black line runs west, and then there's a circle, yellow circle with the number two. That is the little town of San Carlos de Bariloche. That's incredibly important. And there's a huge lake right next to it, a lake named Nahuel Huapi. Nahuel means tiger. Huapi means antelope or gazelle, something like that, in an earlier language.
Bariloche is, if I remember, is that not a tourist destination now?
It is now, yes, right, because in the summertime, down there, it's great fishing in the lake, and in the wintertime, there's great skiing in the mountains.
Skiing, yeah. And they have an alpine climate down there. All right.
Exactly. Just the opposite of Bavaria. And we've seen pictures of Scorzini and also Rudel, the super pilot, skiing in the Andes down there near Bariloche. Why were they there? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
All right. We have to take a break here.
Take a break.
Hans Ulrich Rudel.
Yep.
How did I remember that name? The Star of Africa? Or
no,
is he
no,
the,
no, that
he's
was
the Stuka. That's right. He's the Stuka pilot.
Right. Sank a battleship, a cruiser, more than 500 tanks destroyed. They made a special medal for him, the Knight's Cross in gold with oak leaf swords and diamonds. He was the only one that ever got that award.
Didn't he fly with one leg?
That's right. After a while, he only had one leg. He skied with one leg, too, down there by Bariloche.
Unbelievable. Just incredible people.
Yeah.
All right. We'll stop right there and come right back in just a few minutes with Harry Cooper. Hope you're enjoying this. It is remarkable. Where we're going is even more remarkable. So don't go away. Okay, back with Harry Cooper. And if you just joined us, by all means, load the photos. You'll see under Harry's name and guests at Rents.com. We're up to photo number 35. We're taking a look at that. It is a map of the lower portion of Argentina. We've talked about number one and number two on the back. On the left side is number two. That's currently known as Bariloche. It's an alpine environment. It's gorgeous, gorgeous countryside, an enormous lake, and skiing in the winter. Okay, go ahead,
right.
Harry.
Okay, well, let's scroll down to number 36. This is something that just popped up, and we're still getting our ducks in the water on this one. That's a Blumenvoss BV-138 flying boat. In German, the Luftwaffe call it a Seedrache, which means sea dragon, but The nickname was Fliegende Holzschuh, which means the flying wooden shoe because of the way it looks. This is just a stock shot, but we are just now getting information from our very top spook, as we call him, Sieg agent, whatever, guy we call Pizarro. On the 2nd of May, 1945, one of these guys landed on the Wannsee, which is the lake by Berlin. And there's a lot more still coming in, but it took off with people on board it. We don't have the rest of it filled in just yet.
Now, that you have to remember, this is after Berlin allegedly fell.
Well, this was the 2nd of May,
right?
And there was just hard fighting. And that's in the current issue of our magazine, which is going to be sent out to members on Sunday or Monday. So if any listeners want to join Shark Hunters and get that particular issue, all you got to do is go to sharkhunters.com or send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net. But all that's on the website.
Okay. So that was 2 days after Hitler was allegedly dead and gone.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. So, and we found that the registration number on the plane was D for Deutschland, 1 plus FL. Okay, that's all I can tell you right now because that's all I have absolute positive on.
Until
we get the next thing coming in, which should be coming in shortly.
That's amazing. You are finding things that shouldn't exist.
Right. This came from an interrogation from a sergeant who was on that particular flying boat. The weird airplane, three engines, one on each wing, which had a three-bladed prop, then one up over the cockpit, which had a four-bladed prop, and they were all diesel engines.
Huh.
So, okay, now let's fast forward to July of 1945. For some reason, the Brazilians, again, pulled their people off that island, Trindade, and a German contingent showed up, and they were there until at least middle 1947, as I said, to provide fresh water, food, etc. The island is loaded with fresh water. There are streams and creeks and ponds all over that island. And a German sailor got killed accidentally in July 1945, which is what, 2 months, 3 months after the war ended, and we saw the marker for his grave. So what's a German sailor doing there 2 months after the surrender? Well, obviously, he was working. Now, the first one of the two boats that surrendered way after the war was U-530, and it's photo number 37. The guy who's looking off into space, that's Otto Wermuth, the skipper, and he was a member of Shark Hunters. And from the time he took over the boat from the previous captain, it was used for spook missions. He was he met with a Japanese I boat off the coast of Africa and handed them several tons of gold and silver, and he took war material from that boat, and he got back to the French base, but the Japanese boat got sunk with all that gold on it. It's down 19,000 feet, so it's going to stay there. And he surrendered 2.5 months after the war ended down at Mar del Plata, which is the big Argentine submarine base several hundred miles south of Buenos Aires. He surrendered 2.5 months after the war was over.
This picture is depicting?
That's correct. He's on the dock in Mar del Plata.
One of his crew is
smoking a cigarette.
Politely manhandled on the right of the picture by probably an Argentine sailor.
Yeah, it looks that way.
Led away, okay.
Yeah. And then the next one, 38, is his arrest photo and paper.
Mugshot.
Yeah, mugshot. Now, photo 39 is interesting because he and Heinz Schaefer, that's photo 40, U-977, they both stated that they threw all their paperwork overboard. There was no paperwork left on board either one of these boats. Yet you see that tub right there, and it says Submarinos Alemanos, I mean German submarines, U-530 and U-977. I took that photo, I saw the paperwork. That's only a small portion of it, but they had no paper left on board the submarines at all, except here it is. And if you remember back to photo number 4, Peter Hansen, he was flown down to Argentina in 47, 2 years after the war ended, to translate all these papers that didn't exist for the Argentine Navy.
How did you see them, Harry? Where were they?
Oh, they've got a little museum there, and they keep these in a secure area. But because I was a visiting guest, and I've got a friend who's an officer there in the Argentine Navy, he got me introduced to the people that run it, and they hauled them out. They told me I could come back and look at them anytime I want to. Of course, I can't read the old-fashioned German, so I'd have to bring somebody with me. But, you know, the point is they claim there was no paperwork left on the two boats.
Yes.
They threw it all overboard, but yet here it is. And in 47, Peter Hansen, photo 4, was flown down there to translate all these papers that didn't exist for the Argentine Navy.
Translate them into what language?
Oh, into Spanish for the Argentine Navy.
Okay, photo 40.
Yep.
Go ahead.
That is U-977. That was Heinz Schaefer. He surrendered in the same place 2 weeks after 530. He surrendered 3 months after the war ended. He's the one that went down to Britain, back to Norway, and then all the way down to Mar del Plata, a voyage of about 10,000 miles with a boat that, if it had full fuel tanks, could only make 6,000 miles, and he only had 3/4 of a fuel load, but yet he still made it.
He refueled somewhere.
You would think so, yeah. And he claimed in his book, Heinz Schaefer wrote a book that anybody interested in U-boats must have read. It's called U-Boat 977. And one of his big claims in there was that he saved fuel by running totally submerged for 66 days and only breathing through the snorkel. Well, that makes no sense at all if you know anything about physics.
No, it's the opposite.
That's right. You're pushing all that superstructure through there. And another one of our agents, we call him Michael Ivanheim, he got a hold of the documents and the interrogation from the Argentine Navy. And Schaefer was told to prepare false documents showing where he would have been if he'd have been 66 days underwater, so that they could show those to the Americans. But he was, you know, the comparison, it's all in that book, The Secret Alliance.
977 looks pretty beaten up there.
Yeah, it went a long way, yeah.
Yeah. Now, and, what happened to that vessel?
Both that one and U-530, which surrendered in the same place 2 weeks before, were handed back to the United States Navy. They were brought back up as spoils of war, whatever, and were used for torpedo targets off the east coast of the United States. So they're both sitting on the bottom somewhere, but there's not much left of them. A submarine that gets hit by a torpedo is usually pretty well blasted, and now they've been underwater, what, 65, 70 years? The salt water is not very nice.
No.
So now we look back at that photo 35, which shows Bariloche, and we look. I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Well, you're on the map. We've passed the map.
Right, the map. But now we look up to
41.
Yeah, 41. Who would want to go to this little rinky-dink town, Bariloche? Well, here's one guy. Professor Kurt Tank. He's the guy that designed the Focke-Wulf FW-190, one of the great fighters of World War II. The U.S. wanted him. They were trying to catch him in Operation Paperclip. The Soviets wanted him, and he decided he didn't want either one, so he snuck up through Denmark, hitched a ride on a boat across to Norway, and then made it all the way down to Argentina, where he lived and retired in Bariloche.
When was this picture taken, number 41, approximately?
That was taken during the war. And he was talking with some Luftwaffe pilots. But he went down to Bariloche. Well, he went to Argentina after the war. He He designed various fighter planes for South American forces, including the Pulque for the Argentine Air Force. Pulque, I think, is one of the indigenous native words for arrow.
He should have built some 190s for them.
Well, by then it was jet age.
Understand, I'm joking.
Yeah.
All right.
Then we go to number 42.
Okay. We're going to go right through this, Brett. Thank you. Okay, number 42.
42. That's his rank was Sturmbannführer, which about the same as a captain. He's in the SS. His name is Erich Priebke. Maybe he's a member of Shark Hunters. He's going to turn 100 years old in July.
Yeah, I've heard the name.
Okay, he was the one that in 1995, Sam Donaldson went down there and outed him. Sam Donaldson, the guy with the fiberglass toupee.
Yeah, the big coup, I remember.
Yeah, that idiot. And so now poor old Priebke is under house arrest in Rome. But he was also in Bariloche. He was the headmaster at the German school in Bariloche. He was the head of the German Cultural Center in Bariloche. I had dinner with his son 2 years ago. So here's another guy winds up in little old Bariloche. Now we zip to photo 43. Who are these guys? Looks like a bunch of scientists marching up.
Where are they? Where is this picture?
This is on an island in that Lake Nahuelwapi. And we're coming to that. That's Dr. Ronald Richter, one of the world's top nuclear physicists. So let's roll up to 44.
Okay, that island is in the middle of the lake at Bariloche.
Right. Well, not in the middle of the lake.
It's out there, okay.
A quarter mile offshore, one spot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, item 44. That is not the Costa Concordia, and it's not one of the carnival ships.
I got it.
This is a boat that had been running people back and forth to the island, and that is the Ratty Dam dock that was built by the Germans in 1947. That's when he started this nuclear research laboratory, which we'll get to in a minute.
Richter?
Yeah, Richter. Two years after the war ended.
Mm.
Well, the Germans maintained that dock real well, but the Argentinians didn't, and I jumped up out of our little rubber boat and fell right through the doggone dock, ripped big chunks out of my left arm. But at least I made it up there alive. Richter had built an atomic research laboratory there on this island by Bariloche, right offshore.
For whom?
Aha!
Aha!
Let's look at picture number 45. That's the town of Bariloche. It's where you were in Bavaria. And we went to a restaurant. I think I told you this once before. We went to a restaurant, and the guy met us at the door, and he was about 6 foot tall, maybe 80 years old, blue eyes, blonde hair. He couldn't speak English. I don't speak Spanish. He was trying to explain the menu, the specials in Spanish to my Argentine friends who were telling me in English, and it wasn't working. So on a hunch, I said, bitte mein Herr, ich möchte eine Speisekarte mit englischer Schreiben. Please, or like an English menu. Instantly, oh, mein Freund, haben Sie nicht? And we talked for about 2 minutes in German. Then I asked him in German. I said, you speak good German. Why? And he put his hand over his mouth and, oh, ich bin Schweizer. I'm Swiss. Yeah, but we had him singing all the old German military songs.
Now, that's a fascinating story. You told me quite a bit about that gentleman.
Yeah.
So at first, his reflex, as has been the case since the war, or since he got there, as to claim that he's Swiss.
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right. Well, that's that's something that many of them did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So now we roll down to photo number 46.
But do you want to tell about the dinner you had?
You remember that, don't you?
I certainly do.
Okay.
This is a fascinating story.
Okay. When during that time, that was in 2008 when I went by myself with my two Argentine friends down there, and he was playing a chifa clavier, which is like an accordion only with buttons on both sides instead of keys, and he had an Argentine buddy playing a guitar, and they were singing gaucho songs, And I went to him and asked if he could play the Matrosan lead, the sailor song, which is what the U-boaters always sang when they were heading out to attack England. Oh, no, no, don't know that. Okay, fine. So I'm sitting back.
You've never heard of it before, right?
Right, okay. Right. Didn't know nothing about it. So I'm sitting back enjoying some great Argentine steak with my Argentine buddies. And suddenly we hear, "My dog, old and beer and lead light sing." And he went through the entire Matrosan lead. Then he went through the entire Panzer lead, the song of the armored division. And I smiled and gave him a thumbs up. He stood up, snapped his heel, stuck his right arm straight out in the air.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Was he, had he had a few beers?
No. He just felt he was in with comfortable company.
How fascinating. That must have been amazing.
I came back a year later and I had a group of people with me, a small group. Two of them were hardcore right wingers from Germany. One was a retired colonel, Oberst. And they had this poor guy there until 2 o'clock in the morning. I went back to the hotel and went to bed about 10. They had this guy singing all the old wartime songs. And finally at 2 in the morning, he said, "Hey, look, I gotta go to bed. Get out of here."
Amazing.
Yeah. So you can get along well in that town with German language. Now, look to 46.
We're
back on the island.
Right.
That's all that's left of the reactor building. The, excuse me, the other building.
You just said reactor building.
Yeah.
This is amazing. Now, this is, what, 1947 that was built?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right.
Now, if your listeners go to our website, sharkhunters.com, then click on previous tours, and then you'll get all those listed, and you click on Argentina. You see a whole mob of these photos of all the buildings there. They had a laboratory building. They had workshop buildings that are still standing. Dr. Richter's house is still there. You know, they're in pretty rough shape, but not as rough as this. This looks like it was blown up. And
Harry, I've got to ask you again. Who was footing the bill for this research?
Juan Perón.
He wanted the bomb.
He wanted to be the first nuclear power in South America. Now, if you look, I don't know if you can Google it, but if you look into this, you'll find that one side says they achieved the first and probably the only cold fusion reaction. But then it was debunked by some guy who came out to test it, and it didn't work. But then they looked and found out that Richter had disconnected a lot of his equipment. And the theory there is that Juan Perón wanted to be the big Goomba there with the nuclear power, but Martin Bormann didn't want people knowing that it was there.
Now, you just said Martin Bormann. Martin Bormann died, everybody knows that, in Berlin in 1945.
Right. And on December 24th, there was some fat guy coming down your chimney with a sack full of toys.
That's right.
Now, Martin Bormann had been seen in Argentina so many times, and he and Perón opened some joint bank accounts together in his own name.
Really, in his own name. That's how confident he felt.
Oh, yeah. They were protected down there.
Uh-huh.
We'll cover the topic of why didn't they go after him.
All right. I remember going back to the first part of our conversation, it was Bormann who allegedly drugged Hitler and Braun.
Yeah, he had them drugged under his orders. And Don Angel, if you read the first book, The Escape from the Bunker, you'll find in there where Don Angel met with Bormann in 1958. He met with Hitler in 52, but then he met with Bormann in 1958, and Bormann was turning the Reich from using bullets to controlling dollars and companies that he could buy with the money that he got out, because he got out with all the bank account numbers. So that's who
you just said something very interesting. You said Don Angel met with Adolf Hitler in 1952. We're going to get to that. We're going to go, I think, all 3 hours tonight, Harry, so don't rush.
Okay.
I want to hear
make,
as much.
I'm going to make some tea while I'm talking to you.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here in a minute, so you'll have
some bills.
Several minutes, yeah. This is all obviously extraordinary and unprecedented in talk radio. I don't think any other talk radio at this level has ever touched this subject. I hope you're interested in what we're talking about. It's going to get much more interesting as we continue. So Bariloche, the resort town of Argentina, was apparently the home to an awful lot of Germans.
Before it was discovered, yeah.
Correct. Very high-ranking Germans, in fact, the highest-ranking Germans, and many others. And it does look, there are parts of it I've been told by others who I've known who have been there, it looks very much like a little Bavarian town.
It does indeed.
Okay. Now, what we're doing is taking a picture tour, along with Harry's brilliant narration, of what happened after the war ended. Many of you are saying, well, how could this go unnoticed by the Allies, the Americans? Well, the answer is, obviously, it didn't. And there's
correct.
Some very high-level understandings and collusions and agreements that we'll touch on as we continue. In just a few minutes with Harry Cooper, SharkHunters.com, the story of what really happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun and Martin Bormann and others as we continue. Welcome back. Harry Cooper, our special guest tonight as we take a look at history as it really happened. We are in Argentina now, learning remarkable things. Juan Perón wanted to be the first Latin American politician, as it were, head of state, to have an atomic bomb. And one of the German scientists there was only too happy to try to construct one for him. Was this gentleman working on the German nuclear program? He had to be.
I would imagine. I don't know that for sure, but it would be the obvious connection because they didn't just take some
right.
schmo off the street and say, hey, look, you're going to direct the nuclear plant.
Well, he was a physicist of some kind, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
And Germany had been very advanced in their nuclear research. We'll get to that directly.
All right.
So we left off on photo 46, the destroyed reactor building. Now, as I say, if your listeners will go to sharkhunters.com and then go to previous tours, click on Argentina, they'll see dozens of photos. I mean, with these new electronic cameras, you don't have to pay to develop film. You just shoot a whole ton of photos.
So it's amazing.
Go to the website, and they're all identified what it is. So, now we go down to number 47. These are right outside the reactor building, and I'm told they're called cooling drums or something like that, but they're not a drum like you would say. They're not hollow. You knock on them, they are solid steel or whatever that is, and you can't move them because they weigh a ton. And after we were sitting on them and had our water bottles on them and everything, the next year we came back with a Geiger counter and found out, okay, it was safe. We weren't going to glow in the dark. So then we move on to 47A.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit of an uphill shot. Now, that's one of the laboratory buildings you're seeing there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole complex. And like I say, you'll see them all when you go to the website and click previous tours.
Juan's Bomb.
That would have been interesting, wouldn't it?
Juan's Bomb.
That was my career field in the Air Force, was thermonuclear weapons.
Really?
We saw what they did, so
yeah.
It's best you don't let somebody else have them. Now we're coming down to the nitty and the gritty. The the executives at Mercedes of Argentina had a big estate built just toward the end of the war here on this lake, up a finger of this lake.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, it's a huge lake. Excuse me. And you could only get to this estate by boat up this long finger of the lake. So we scroll down to number 48. You see that watchtower in the yellow circle?
Yep.
Okay, it's still there. I took that photo.
And that's on the island.
No, that's on a point of land sticking out. Now we've left the island. We're going up the finger of this lake.
Okay.
This was taken by one of my friends there. And this was built about the same time the estate was built.
Hmm.
And if you were coming from this direction
mm-hmm.
to go up the finger to that lake, or to that estate, I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
you had to pass this tower.
Hmm.
And there would be a small contingent of people there.
So we're going, just to rehash this, we're on the lake. We're going to the shore. We're going up finger of the lake.
That's correct.
Up a finger of the lake. Keep that in mind. And
yep.
to transit this finger, you had to go within full view of this watchtower.
That's correct, because it's only about 200 yards wide there, the lake part here. You had to go through a narrow pass. And this watchtower, they would see you, and they would communicate to the estate, hey, a boat is coming. Now, go down to number 49, where I look like, what a stupid photo. I look like a hood ornament on a Stutz Bearcat.
That's not a bad analogy, or... something on the front of an old sailing ship, but a masculine version of it.
Oh, God. Anyhow, if you came from the other direction, you had to pass a bunker. And I'm standing on the ruins of the bunker. Not a combat bunker that could withstand bombs and things like that, but just a shelter bunker where they could put maybe a platoon of people. And again, if you came that direction, they let the people at the estate know, somebody's coming.
Hmm.
So now we've gone past. Now you see how narrow that cut is between where I'm standing and the hill on the other side of that piece of the water.
All right. That's a couple hundred yards, you say?
Yeah. So anybody right. coming by, they're spotted.
On either side, all right.
That's correct.
All right.
So now we've passed either the bunker or the watchtower, and we beach our little boat, and my feet are on the sand when I'm taking photo 50.
Who are you with?
One of my Argentine friends,
okay.
a guy named Nahuel. So he was my translator. And so we had to walk from where I'm standing. We beached our boat.
Photo 50, Harry Cooper is standing in the sand.
Yep.
At the end of that little inlet, that finger off the lake, all right, and you see a beautiful Bavarian-style chalet.
Right, and that was the estate built at the end of the war allegedly with Mercedes money. Now, when we came here again in the next year, 2009, I had some people with me, and so I rented two small cabin cruisers to bring us there. And when we got landed, and you see how much we had to walk across the grass. One of our boat captains, who's guessing about 60 years old, he's walking along in front of me with his left index finger under his nose like a mustache, his right arm straight out in the air, and he's goose-stepping.
You're kidding.
So I threw my interpreter. I said, "What in the hell are you doing?" And he smiled. He said, "I know who lived here." And I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "I grew up here. My father was the caretaker." And again, he snapped his right arm up in the air and went back to his boat. So this is where we are quite certain Uncle Adi lived until 1955, when the place was discovered as a tourist haven.
Bariloche.
People began to
come to Bariloche. Too many people. We're going to go right through this break, Brett.
We're stepping all over your hard breaks, aren't we?
That's all right. This is a very special program. That is a beautiful location.
Yeah, there are several guest homes. And if you read the book, Escape from the Bunker, Don Angel explains how he flew down to a special compound to meet with Hitler. That was in August of 1952. Now, August is the dead of winter down there. And he said in his book that he had gone to Antarctica. Now, either he was mistaken or it was deliberate disinformation, because the way he describes the buildings fits this place. And again, if you go to sharkhunters.com, previous tours, and look at this, you see there's lots of photos. You see all the other outbuildings. There's a separate little tiny building where there's a generator to make the power. There's another little building that's the kitchen, so you don't heat up the house, and other, as I say, guest houses. And there's also a boathouse, which the guy who took us there in the boat told us, don't go in, there's rats in there. So we figured, who cares, the rats will run. He says, no, there's rat poop about 4 inches deep all over the floor, and if you breathe the air, it's bad. So, well, apparently I didn't die from it yet. Funny out here.
That's a beautiful construction. Look at the heavy timbers on that. See the Bavarian,
gorgeous.
The ends of the beams sticking out.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
That's clever. I got two number 52s. Well, nobody ever called me dumb and didn't mean it.
No. Let me go back to Don Angel.
Sure.
His 1952 August meeting with Adolf Hitler.
Right.
Did he describe that in any detail, how Hitler looked, what he was talking about? Was Eva Braun there?
No, he didn't see Eva Braun. After he helped Martin Bormann get to Argentina, he moved out of Spain to Mexico City, and he was working for the Reich as a spy in the end of the 40s and into the 50s. And one of his tasks was to just keep an eye on two young children who were growing up in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Now, we don't know who these children were related to or anything, but the boy's name was Adolfo, and the girl's name was Stern, which means star. And so he was ordered to go down and meet with Hitler in August of 52, and bring the files with the photos. And so
of these two children?
Of the two children, yeah. And so when he got there, now he didn't know Hitler was still breathing. He got there and he was given a place to sleep in one of the outbuildings, given a meal the next morning. He went into the main building, and according to what he said, he met an SS colonel who asked, did you bring the files? He said, yes. And the colonel said, yes, well, go in and make your report to the Führer. And Don Angel said, what do you mean when you say the Führer? And the guy said, there's only one, Adolf Hitler. So Don Angel went into the room, and there were two officers doing something with a map, he said. And there was the man they referred to as the Führer. He said he was in really bad physical shape. He was bald, and his left hand just trembled all the time. I guess that's Parkinson's.
Or neurological damage from the explosion and the bomb assassination attempt. Could have been Parkinson's.
Whatever it was, he was in pretty rough shape.
Did he say anything about the mustache? Probably would have gotten rid of it.
He said it had been shaved off.
You know, if you've seen pictures of Adolf Hitler after his World War One stint and during the war, he had a full mustache.
A big mustache, yeah.
Quite a very handsome man at the time.
Oh, he was a young guy.
Yeah.
So anyhow...
he had to have had his heart skip a beat or two. This is like seeing a ghost.
Yeah, he was. He describes that in the book. And he said that Hitler asked, did you bring the files? He said, yes. He handed him the files. And he started looking over the files, and the colonel brought him in, tugged at his elbow, and he said, you know, it was time to leave. Oh, he also said that Hitler was drooling a little from the left corner of his mouth. So apparently the left side of his body wasn't working all that well.
Possible stroke.
Could have been, yeah.
Common.
He was not a kid, and it was a pretty tough life.
Yeah.
So, well, then we
was there any question in Don Angel's mind that this was the man?
In his letters to me, he said it was. In the letter we used to write the book, he said, and so Hitler, if this was Hitler, and then he went on with the sentence. But in the letters he wrote me, which I still have here, he said it was.
Now, understand why he would do that, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
When this whole thing first started, there was a another Shark Hunters member, a guy named Captain Bob Thew, T-H-E-W.
Now, by the way, Don Angel would have met him in this structure we're seeing.
Yes, correct.
All right.
So anyhow, this guy, Bob Thew, he was a retired U.S. Navy captain. He had been naval intelligence his whole life in the Navy. Then he was NSA for another 20 years. So he came to visit, and he was sitting on my sofa in my house in 1988 when we were in Tampa. And I asked him if he had ever heard of Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco. And he kind of chuckled. He says, yeah, I heard of him. I said, well, was he a spy? He says, yeah. He just wasn't a very good spy because we all knew he was a spy. And I said, well, this guy's nuts. I said, he told me in this letter, I said, he met with Hitler in 1952. I said, everybody knows Hitler committed suicide in the bunker. And he just as calmly as if he was asking for another cup of coffee, he says, no, he didn't. We knew he didn't kill himself. I said, who's we? He said, the intelligence community. We knew Hitler got out. So he confirmed it. And he was a captain in the United States Navy, naval intelligence.
Well, ONI is a very competent and entirely respected organization.
Correct. And he said it, and like I say, we've got a ton of documents from the FBI, the OSS. Stalin was screaming in July, 3 months after the war ended. He was screaming at England and the United States that they weren't doing enough to find Hitler. Well, if you got the dead body in April, what are you looking for him in July?
Sure.
So, you know, it's a nice story. My theory on that, I don't know. I was a kid during the war years, so I remember it. In the early part of the war, we were fighting Germany, Japan, and Italy. When it was obvious we were going to win, they personalized that we were fighting Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini. I guess so they could rebuild the countries after the war. Well, we know what happened to Mussolini. Wound up hanging in a gas station, machine gunned. Right. We know what happened to Tojo. Shot himself, we nursed him back to health, and then hanged him. But then Hitler, he got away, and they couldn't very well say, well, we got two out of three. So that's my theory. They made this story up. And
when you say they made this story up, elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, it's just like I say, my theory is that they invented the story that he committed suicide in the bunker.
All right.
And let it go at that.
Now, who would have made that story up? I don't need names, but the Allies.
Probably the U.S., because Stalin was screaming that he wanted the U.S. to catch him.
Well, we got to remember that the government here in this country, the FDR administration, was riddled with Soviet spies, Harry Hopkins and all the rest.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, FDR would just kind of wink and ignore it. He knew what was going on.
Right.
And ultimately, Joe McCarthy, one of the great American patriots, tried to expose it. That's another story, though.
And he paid that price, didn't he?
Yeah, they killed him, too.
Yeah. Well, let's continue on, and this might add a little more to it. Now, we've gone through the interior of the house.
His pictures are extraordinary, by the way.
52-53. Incidentally, the house is for, the whole estate is for sale. If you have $40 million U.S. dollars, you can own it. So it'll be for sale for quite a while, I think.
I'm sure.
Now,
that,
let's look at
that. Are we to think that the furniture in there dates back to that time, or just the structure?
The structure. That Some of the furniture looks old, but some of the furniture is new. So, you know, like there were other people living in it way later.
That old wooden table, that enormous dining table.
I think once they put that sucker in there, it stayed.
It doesn't go anywhere, no.
Yeah, that thing probably, I'll bet you that thing weighed every bit of 1,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Solid oak. So.
Did you have, Harry, excuse me, at this point, did you have a feeling that the Reich was still functioning at some level on the international stage in the shadows?
Absolutely.
Okay. How might that have been configured? What would you say about it? What was it doing?
I think they shifted more to a business structure.
Heavy industry?
Yeah, owning various businesses.
Farben, now, Mercedes, and
BMW.
Okay.
And
so they had holdings.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. One of our people down, living down there, not Noel, but another guy who I won't mention, tracked down a lady who had been a waitress and had waited on Hitler and Eva in a hotel up in Cordova, where we went in 2010. And he tracked her down. Her name is Catalina. I can't remember the last name.
That's enough.
But it's in the files.
So she actually... All right, tell me more. This is interesting.
Okay, well, she waited on Hitler and Eva Braun at this hotel, which they used to frequent after they moved out of Bariloche. They moved up to Cordova province. And bear in mind, back in those days, this was almost on the other side of the dark side of the moon, because Bariloche is 700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires with no roads, and Cordova was 400 miles northwest, again, with no roads. If you're listening,
northwest of Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires, yeah.
So he went from one end of the country to the other, pretty much.
Well, more or less, it's a much bigger country. But
Cordova would be closer to the subtropical climate, obviously.
Correct. And if your listeners go to the website, there's again previous tours. When I took a group up there to Cordova, we went to the little town Villa General Belgrano, which is the town that was formed by the crew of the battleship Graf Spee after they blew it up, and so they got resettled. They married Argentine girls, and they started this town. And again, we stayed in the Old Bavaria Hotel. That was the name of it, the Old Bavaria Hotel. And we spoke German, and I went to a gift shop to buy something for my wife, and the guy didn't speak English, of course, and I don't speak Spanish, so on a whim, I asked him, you know, sprechen Sie Deutsch? You speak German? Oh, no, but he got all excited, picked up the phone, made a phone call, momentito, por favor, momentito. Well, I know what that means, stick around. And about 5 minutes later, this good-looking young kid of about 28 years old, blue eyes, blonde, 6 foot tall, he came and we conversed in German. His grandfather had been a lieutenant general, General Leutnant, who was an adjutant to Kurt Panzermeier. So they're down there. So anyhow, my friend was going to go visit Catalina, and he called her and he talked to her, and Catalina said she had photos and would be happy to give him an interview.
Wait. She had photos of?
Of Hitler and Eva Braun in the hotel where she worked.
And are these photos around?
Well, she's got them. So anyhow, he drove all the way up there.
Is she still alive?
I don't know. I'm still trying to find out. She was alive 2 years ago. We're still trying to nail her down.
Okay, we need to find out about those photos, obviously.
Absolutely. But when my friend drove about 1,000 kilometers to her house, she met him at the door, very quiet, and said, they told me I cannot say anything while the lady is still alive. This was in 2004, so we get the idea that maybe Eva Braun was still alive in 2004. She was born in 1912, so that would have made her, what, 90-something, which isn't that impossible. But anyhow, Catalina just kind of shut the door in his face. So who is they? In German, they're called Die Spinner. the spider. In the movie, they were called Odessa. So they're still there.
Okay, so we're to think, running up on the end of this hour, we've got another hour to go, we're to think that Hitler moved from, and Eva moved from Bariloche to Cordoba, where the Graf Spee community was set up.
Yeah, I'm not sure he moved to that particular place, but that's where we were one of the days we were there.
All right. And
there are two old hotels. When you get back from your break, if you want to hit your break now, then we'll tell you about
the
hotels.
It's coming up in about, we had another minute or so. But the idea that Hitler and Eva went to hotels and restaurants, they were comfortable enough, and this woman knew who they were, and had, they allowed pictures to be taken of them, apparently.
Yep. One of the hotels was owned by a German family, the Eichhorn family. Eichhorn means acorn. And they had been strong supporters of Hitler before the war. They had sent him lots of money. They had a huge resort hotel. And this one, like I say, is 400 miles northwest of Buenos Aires, out in the middle of nowhere. They had a big, long garage facility with Model T Fords that people could use to run around Cordoba. And it's still standing, but it's in really bad repair now. But your listeners can...
The suggestion here is that Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun lived in the area and would come into the hotel for dinner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. We don't know...
Oh, I hear the music coming up.
Yeah, we don't know where, but somewhere in the area.
Right.
Somebody knows.
Correct.
All right. Back in a minute with the remarkable Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, as we continue our amazing story. Okay, and we're back. Hour three of our fascinating travels with Harry Cooper, looking at history in an entirely new light. All right, Harry, go ahead with the story, if you would.
Okay, we were just moving to photo 54.
Correct.
Does anybody recognize him? That is Standartenfuhrer, which is a colonel, Otto Gunsche. He was a member of Sharkhunters. He was also Hitler's personal adjutant.
Attaché, right?
Yeah, attaché, aide-de-camp, whatever you want to call him. He's the one that carried the bodies outside to be burned, but whose bodies? He wouldn't tell anybody, and he was close-lipped about it until some years ago when, after his wife passed away, I guess maybe that was a sword held over his head. I don't know. But here you look at 55, that's him again. That's one of the last photos ever taken of him. He had just had his 88th birthday. This was some years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And he was in great physical shape. He was a big man, 6 foot something. And 1.5 weeks, I think it was, after his 88th birthday, his housekeeper found him in the sauna at 9 o'clock in the morning from 3 o'clock the previous afternoon. And the temperature was set at 85 degrees Celsius, which is about 185 degrees Fahrenheit.
He suffered the same fate Rudolf Hess did.
only in a different way.
Different kind of a box.
That's correct. Instead of hanging himself.
In a jail cell.
Right, with arms that he couldn't lift above his waist.
Right, he died. They killed him
maybe
in a sauna.
Maybe he was getting ready to talk. I don't know. But.
Where was he living?
In Germany. Naturally, most of them lived in Germany. So that's, you know, so suspicious.
Now, he was in your organization?
Yeah, he was a member.
And you had spoken to him?
Nope. He just got the magazine. He didn't.
Didn't want to interact.
Nope. He just got our magazine, and that was it. And sent us $50 every year. Now, you look down at number 56.
I remember him being quoted as he gave a description of how he had carried with another person the bodies out and burned them.
Right.
Dumped petrol on them and lit them on fire.
Right, and gasoline, of course, doesn't do much toward...
No, you have to get a tremendous heat to burn a body. It's difficult to burn, actually.
Yeah, especially since your body's like, what, 75% water?
Water, yeah.
Water doesn't burn real good.
Okay.
So.
Well, he stood on that story for a long time, and maybe he was getting ready to write his memoirs, and they were listening to everything. This is 4 or 5 years ago he died?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
All right. Well, they kill people all the time.
Oh, right. No kidding.
Yeah.
We're doing a story. This is shifting a bit, but another member of Shark Hunters who was a friend of mine, Jörg Haider, who was the political strongman in Austria.
You knew George?
Yeah, sure.
Well, they killed him, too.
We're about to come out with a book on that stuff that nobody knows about. Photo taken of his car 1 week before the wreck. Somehow, different wheels, different tires, different serial number. But that's another story. Yeah, well, there's another thing. Go to sharkhunters.com, go to previous tours, and click on our Southern Patrol. You'll see us with me with Haider. I met him in 1990. He was a very decent man.
Yeah, I understand that.
So he got whacked. Hell, even John F. Kennedy got whacked by his own government.
Right.
So anyhow, look at number 56. And all I'm saying is look at number 56 and draw your own conclusion.
Now, let's pause here for a minute.
Okay.
If you can, where did the photo come from?
I got it from my guy in South America who was supposed to get the pictures of Hitler and Eva Braun from Catalina.
Okay.
He didn't say who this was. He just sent it and said, take a look and
enjoy.
You decide. Yep.
All right. When you look at the picture, there is a bandana
over his head, yeah.
On the sun side, which would be our right, his left.
Yep.
We can clearly see the right eye staring right at us.
Mm-hmm.
And I would simply invite you to look at the picture on the right and add a lifetime of stress and pressure and grief, and then look back at the left side, our left. You see the bald head. And
the nose is exactly the same.
It's just older.
Yeah, right. And the downturned mouth, the same, only more pronounced.
Age. Stroke.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the ears on the number 56, they're a little bigger, but as men age, their ears get bigger.
So do their noses. Their noses never stop growing.
Oh.
Also, the head is slightly turned, and the ear would present in a more forthright view. I'm not going to say this is or isn't. I'm going to leave this up to you folks. As they say, take it or leave it. That eye... It's an extraordinary eye looking out from under that bandana.
Yeah, and it's the same kind of little curves underneath the eye in both pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So now the next big question people always ask, why didn't they go after him? And, of course, I respond by saying, who is they? Oh, well, they think for a minute, well, Israel. Why didn't Israel go after him? Well, there was no such thing as Israel in 1945. Oh, well, then they say, what about the Mossad? Well, there was no Mossad in 1945. And, well, what about America? Okay, we knew where he was. Like I say, we have tons of documents. And in that book, Escape from the Bunker, we reproduced quite a few of them in there. The point, my theory, and that's all it is, it's my theory, but my theory based on 30 years of doing this, plus... as I said, my career field in the Air Force was thermonuclear weapons. We theorized that once he got away, they played let's make a deal, you leave Hitler live out his life quietly in peace, and we'll give you all this technology. Now, when I was in my first few weeks of Special Weapons, we saw the films of the American atomic bomb program, and the U.S. was struggling. And then all of a sudden, zingo bingo, we had everything we needed.
All of a sudden, we had two bombs.
Yeah. And I'm thinking that might be the situation. Now, we know where some of the uranium came from. There was a big cargo submarine. U-234 was the number. And it was a converted mine layer, 294 feet long, 1,600 tons. And the mine tubes were taken out of it. The interior mine tubes were taken out to make room for storage space. And the skipper was a member of Shark Hunters, and I spent a day with him in his house. The first officer was a member, the cargo officer was a member, and the chief radioman was also a member of Shark Hunters. And they were headed for Tokyo, but as they got into the North Atlantic, the surrender order came, and so they came and surrendered in the United States. On board that submarine, they had General Ulrich Kessler from the Luftwaffe and his whole staff. They were going to start, they were going to clean house with the Luftwaffe staff in Tokyo. They had Dr. Heinz Schlicke, who later became a member of Shark Hunters. He was one of the world's foremost authorities on magnetic suppression. They had two Japanese technical scientists on board who were also in the Japanese Navy. Back in those days, everybody was in the military one way or another. They had two ME-262 jet fighters in crates with all the technological data to rebuild them so Japan could start building jet fighters, and they had 560 kilos of uranium. And they surrendered that in the United States in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And supposedly, even Robert Oppenheimer came aboard the boat after it was in. We have a copy of the manifest.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of our members was a swabby back then, and he managed to get aboard the boat, snatch one of the translated copies that the U.S. had.
Hmm.
So, no, where did that uranium go? 560 kilos. That's about 1,200 pounds, I guess. Where did it go? Nobody seems to know, and there's no paper trail. It's just sort of, it's in the warehouse with the Ark of the Covenant that Indiana Jones found.
Yeah.
Or we dropped it over Hiroshima. So that's my theory. Leave him alone, let him live out his life in peace, and we'll give you all this stuff. So that's my theory there. Now, we're...
I want to go back to the...
Okay.
The report that Don Angel carried down there,
okay,
in 1952.
Ah, the two children.
The two children.
Yeah.
Who could they have been? What are the possibilities here?
Well, we know what the possibilities are. We know what we're supposed to think.
Mm-hmm.
But we have nothing more on it. Stern and Adolfo. Now, we know Hitler had a son that he fathered right after World War I, who has long since died. But were these his children? Who knows? Are we supposed to think they're his children? Well, yeah, that's probably what we're going to think, whether that's accurate or not.
You've seen the photo of Hitler and Eva with two children.
Yeah, but if I remember correctly, now I'm going from memory here, I think those kids were Eva's sister's children.
Okay. And that picture was, I believe, taken in Germany anyway.
You're right. It was taken at the Berghof, which no longer exists. It was bombed and heavily damaged, but, you know, if the German government would have had any business sense at all, they would have rebuilt his home, plus Goering's home and Bormann's home that were all up on that mountain, and charged people admission to come up there and see him. No, now they just bulldozed them flat. and they put up a sign where the Berenkopf stood, which was up on the over Salzburg, mm-hmm. the mountain outside of a little town called Berchtesgaden. Beautiful, incredibly beautiful place. But now they put up a sign saying that this is where Hitler this is where Hitler hatched the plans to kill 6 billion Jews.
How nice.
Every place he went, that's where he hatched the plan.
Right. The idea of these buildings having been blown up, there I do know at least one person, an American doctor, who went there to pick up pieces of stones that were rubble. The rubble's still there.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that rubble still around. Somebody brought me back a piece of the toilet, a chunk of porcelain out of Hitler's toilet. It's nothing left but rubble. Now, from the hotel where we stay, the Hotel Zum Turken, which used to be the headquarters of his personal guard, which is only 100 yards away, a lot of times at night, I'd be sitting out on the balcony, and it's pitch dark up there, except you can see red candles burning where the Berenkopf used to be. Sometimes you go there, people have laid flowers. Whether you like it or not, that's what's happening. And you go there, and the runic sign of the wolf is carved into some of the trees. Also, the runic sign, which means he has risen, which is the upside-down peace symbol, that's carved into some of the trees. And the cops are busy chopping down trees over there.
Hmm.
They just have...
Well, we know who liquidated around 8 million Germans after the war ended between 1945 and 1953. We know who did that. They were going in there literally and liquidating the remnants of the Reich.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of
oh,
the population. Anybody who had any real strong feelings, and especially the professional class, the scholars and so forth, they were all killed off.
Well, also, you must know the book Other Losses.
I certainly do. James Bakke. Yeah.
James Bakke. All right. He called us way back when he was about to do the book, and he explained it. And I told him I thought that was a great idea. Go ahead and write the book. And he said, well, you have a lot of German members.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I do. I've even got one who was in one of those camps, and he lived through it. And the starvation camp. And I don't know, maybe they think differently up in French Canada, where James Bakke lives, but he says, okay, I want you to give me all the addresses of all your German members. I said,
No, we don't do that.
If you want, I'll set up an interview with any and everyone you want.
Mm-hmm.
He says, no, you will give me those. I said, go F yourself.
Yeah.
Hung up the phone. So his book is an excellent book. Mm-hmm. I've been in the remnants of one of those camps about 3 years ago, and we have a DVD on there where they interview some of the people who were living in that little town at Lager X, and it's in Austria, just south of the German border. And we have a DVD that we sell on that where they're interviewing people. And, you know, the camp guards there, excuse me, these were not the American combat soldiers. These were the slugs who didn't qualified to get into combat, and they sat back in the U.S., and, you know, they wanted to get into combat, but they weren't qualified, I guess, so they were the camp guard. And if somebody tried to sneak, you know, one of the civilians tried to sneak some water to these guys, they'd shoot the bucket out of their hand, and sometimes the bullet would be in such a way it would go through and hit the person that was carrying the bucket. Well, too bad. They're dead. So what?
Right.
Or there were times when some poor guy would be sitting in the field in the camp, and a guard would have nothing else to do. He'd just want to see if he was a good shot. Bang, shoot the guy in the head just because. And I was in the cemetery of that camp, and they were all young kids, 16, 17 years old, or they were old men, old for the time, 45 years old, and they all died in early July. Sooner July. Anyhow, that's as long as they could live without food. And they were deliberately starved to death by Eisenhower.
Eisenhower.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and at West Point, they called him the Swedish Jew, I believe. That was
That's what I understand.
His nickname.
He
certainly hated Germans.
He even wrote that in a letter to his wife. Quote, God, how I hate the Germans, unquote.
Yeah. Well, talk about a Holocaust. He personally supervised the extermination of about 1 million men.
Yeah, over 1 million, yeah. Yeah, but that's okay, though, see, because we won. We had all the war heroes.
They had no rights.
Yeah, the other guys, they were the war criminals. We was the war heroes. Funny how that works out that way.
Yeah. Okay, I'm trying to process in my mind.
A lot coming at you, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm trying to understand how Adolf Hitler could go on living, having been at such astonishing heights historically and in a contemporaneous fashion during that period of history, and then to find himself living essentially in exile,
yeah,
but alive,
and
the going from one extreme to the other.
I'm not so sure it was to the other extreme. He didn't have the big accolades and the power and all that. But every April the 20th, many, many, many SS veterans living down there in Bariloche would have a big whoop-de-doo on the 20th of April at a big fancy resort just over the border into Chile. I can't remember the name of it. I've written it down. Or at a place just outside of Bariloche, it's spelled LLAO-LLAO, and in Argentine Spanish, it's pronounced Chao Chao. I don't know how you get that out of that, but Chao Chao.
Okay.
Big, big, huge, expensive place built 1938, remember?
Mm-hmm.
That was out in the middle of nowhere in 1938.
Well, somebody was planning for something.
I would think so. And then there's a picture, I think it was shot shortly after the war, in front of that hotel with Dwight Eisenhower. What the hell was he doing down there?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a
beautiful place, all heavy wood, beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously expensive.
Do we know, does anyone suggest that Adolf Hitler did any writing later on?
I've never heard that, no. He wrote two books, of course, Mein Kampf.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows that one. It's the second best-selling book ever, second only to the Holy Bible. He did write another book, but that was before or during the war. To the best of my knowledge, nothing after the war. If he did, it disappeared somewhere.
What's interesting to me is that there was a magazine printed in English by the German government during the war called Signal.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite an interesting magazine. I have a few reproduced issues of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them is a map of Europe showing exactly how the Bolshevik communist Zionists would take it over, how the banksters would run everything.
Uh-huh.
They knew.
Yeah.
Like it or not, Stalin killed between 50 and 60 million, perhaps more.
Oh, yeah.
Indirectly.
He was a fun guy.
The alleged Holocaust of 6 million, of course, that number was used by the same people after World War I. It's been used on multiple occasions. I've got essays about that. But the German government, coming out of the Treaty of Versailles and the rebirth of the German people and their heritage, was really the last chance. Remember, World War II was fought in the East against the Bolshevik hordes. 90% of the German military fought in the East.
Right.
People don't know that. The German government was the last chance to stop the international bankers from ruling the world. They didn't believe in usury, and they knew who the enemy was.
Yeah.
And I'm not waving a flag for Germany or anything else. I'm speaking in a very factual sense about this. That's just the truth.
Yeah.
They knew.
Well, nowadays, the European Union, that was pretty well put together by the German banks to solidify the finances over there to combat the Yankee dollar. And they pretty well beat the snot out of it right now.
Well, it's all again history in a whole new perspective that we've been hearing tonight. I'm familiar with much of it. Harry is a master of it, but we have more to discuss. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and do that in just a couple minutes. Okay. Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, and they have so much material there, books, DVDs. It's an extraordinary place to wander around and learn with extraordinary people. Okay, Harry, we got more pictures to look at here.
Okay. One thing, though, let me jump in. You were saying how the map predicted how the Bolsheviks were going to... There was a book that came out in 1932, I think it was, which is quite a while before the war, called Patents for Hitler. And it also predicted there would be a war. It predicted Germany would lose. This was a German book. It predicted Germany would lose. It predicted Germany would be split by the victorious Allies, etc. And it all pretty well came true. So, now, we're going back again to Argentina in January of 2014. That's height of summer for there. And... you know, anybody who would like to go with us, they should contact us, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and we'll send information. We're going back to Bariloche, naturally, for about a week and onto the island. We went around with a metal detector, never found anything exciting, but that's because nobody wanted to work the metal detector.
Mm.
Then this next place, this is Cordova, and this is another place we're going, also to those hotels, which your listeners can see, previous tours, Argentina, Cordova. But now, 57, you see that tunnel in the distance?
Yes.
It's on an old, unused dirt road. Now, here's the tunnel on 58, close up. There was an estate. There is an estate on the other side. And 59, 60, 61 shows... what is left, and 62 shows what is left of that estate and the building that's there. We've got other photos of the building. You won't find those on the website because we haven't got there yet. But
what are we looking at? It looks almost like an outdoor amphitheater, but I assume that's the foundation.
Well, I think it's the swimming pool you're looking at there.
On the side, though, above it.
Well, okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that is a pool of some kind, obviously.
Right, and the amphitheater thing, that was the style they built things
okay.
in back in those days. Many places in the Bahamas, the wealthy people in the 40s. And
well,
50s,
it's kind of
same thing.
Roman, Greco-Roman. Or
Yeah, and maybe they had changing rooms in there, I don't know, or maybe it was just for show.
Okay, yeah.
But,
so that's the swimming pool.
Yeah, needs a lot of water. And another one of our people down there found this place, took all these photos, and from what he's been able to learn, this is where a lot of the guys had to go from the Reich to get their papers, their new identities, etc. So we want to go back down there for another week in January, walk it ourselves, take the photos ourselves, talk to neighbors, old neighbors, and ask for them to fill us in on what was going on.
What are your chances of finding out what happened to the waitress?
We can find out what happened to her fairly simply, but finding her and getting her to talk, another question. But I don't know, I can be pretty persuasive. We'll see.
And this is open to Shark Hunters members and the general public, should they want to join?
Anybody who wants to go along, sure. But, you know, everybody has to pick up the tab for their own travel.
Sure.
And Shark Hunter members always get, we always give them discounts. We're going to Germany the end of, no, middle September this year. Anybody wants to go along on that too, you know, contact me and we'll send you information. The Southern Germany tour, it also goes into Southern Austria. We go into, first off, Nuremberg. We go places that anybody else can go, but then we also go places where it's off limits. We've learned that Eingang verboten really means shark hunters are welcome here. Most
nice.
People think it means entry forbidden.
There is also another side of World War II Germany that very few people know about. It is said that Berlin was something like, I'm going to guess, 75% of Berlin was actually underground.
Oh, and, yeah, not only Berlin, but...
most of the majors.
Yeah, and other places, too. They the so-called experts say for everything the Germans built above ground anywhere, they built three times as much underground.
And this is all sitting there, and people have really no idea, many of them. They're denied access. They're walled off.
Right.
The government doesn't want people going down there.
Right. World War what? Adolf who?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's their attitude. And
sure.
They cop out by saying it's unsafe, and that's a bunch of baloney. There's another one.
Of course.
Under previous tours, you'll see me crawling out of a hole, and that was on a group. A tour we had, 3 years ago, we were walking trail along next to this rise, this hill, whatever you want to call it. And one of the guys with me said, hey, Harry, look, there's a hole up there. And it was about the size of a watermelon, about 6 feet up. So I stuck my arm in with my camera, clicked, took a picture, looked at it. There was a hallway in there. So I squinched through the hole, put on my miner's headlamp. I walked a whole mile into the side of that mountain in a beautifully constructed hallway with doors and rooms off both sides. Nothing in it, of course, anymore. But that part, that was on the Ober Salzburg down near Berchtesgaden by Salzburg.
Hmm.
That hill is just honeycombed with tunnels. We've found so many of them. And again, you'll find that under previous tours. And we go back there. We're going back there this September. And the highlight of that particular tour, though, we go down into southern Austria for a few days, and on the one Sunday, there's a memorial on top of a mountain where there's a destroyed church. And we also found, just off the main area, we found the foundation of a first century Gothic church or something. And there's a big cross up there on the mountain, and they have a memorial service to remember everyone who fell in battle, no matter what uniform they wore.
Hmm.
And we're a guest of honor. And three evenings, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, we have just fellowship evenings with a ton of veterans. Most of them are Waffen-SS, but there are a few Luftwaffe flyboys there, and there's sometimes some of the Navy guys. And there's always a big contingent for the Flamen from Flanders, the Flame of Flanders Division. And they just love talking to the Americans. And if they don't speak English and some of our guys don't speak German, we always find, you know, a friend that'll sit there and translate. And
sure.
Once they start drinking a lot of beer, it all sounds the same.
Everybody speaks the same language.
That's right.
The survivors, the veterans of the Waffen-SS, would they know, is it kind of known that Hitler and Braun made it?
No, it's not very well known at all. Because these guys were just fighting their own battle. And, for instance, the submarines, which, you know, we're the experts on the U-boats.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened in this area, for instance, in such and such area. Okay, a guy who's a commander of a submarine in another area knows nothing about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of them, everyone I've talked to pretty much, believe that Hitler did indeed pop himself in a Führer bunker. Because that's what they were told also.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, some of the hardcore, they don't want to hear that he got out. They want to hear that he died fighting at the head of his troops like...
Well, that's more of a Wagnerian end.
Exactly, like Siegfried out of mm-hmm. Wagner. But that's not the way it was. So, you know, they didn't have overview of everything. So, but a lot of the people who know about it, they're quoted in the book Escape from the Bunker.
Do you have any idea where Hitler and Braun are buried?
No, and I don't want to either.
you'd have a short lifespan if you did, probably.
Yeah, either that or somebody had me tied to a chair with bamboo splinters under my fingers.
Right.
Because you know, some people would want to make it a shrine, and if that's what they want to do, fine, God bless them. Other people would want to blow it up and whatever, and I don't want to get caught in the middle there. So if I knew, I wouldn't tell anybody, but fortunately right now, I don't have any idea. I heard a rumor, and that's all it is. I stress that's all it is, that his body was cremated, and he was put on top of the grave of his mom and dad in Austria, which you can't see anymore because 2 years ago, the wonderful politicians there decided, oh, no, we can't have this. So they took away the entire headstone area. It's not a headstone. It was a plaque up against the church wall. They took it away. The grave is still there. The people are still in the grave, but there's no marker whatsoever. Just like his sister buried at Berchtesgaden at that cemetery, they put somebody else's name plaque over her name. Bless their heart.
Okay, the two children.
Adolfo and Stern.
And again, the daughter was named Star.
Yep, right.
Star. Okay. If they're alive, and they very well may be, would they have been told who their parents were? They probably
would
by this time.
My guess is probably not, because why burden them with the headache? That's just a guess on my part, nothing. You know, we don't know who they are. We don't know if they're still living, although they probably are. They'd be younger than me. Well, I guess that's pretty old anyhow, though, isn't it?
No, no. You got a lot of fire left in that boiler.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got another bunch of years. I haven't made enough people unhappy yet.
Well, this is a remarkable thing that you've shared tonight, and I we're not done yet. We've got one more picture to look at. What is this, number 63?
In the book Escape from the Bunker, Don Angel tells how they dropped him and Martin Bormann off way, way south Patagonia in a little town called Puerto Coig. It's almost at the end of Patagonia. And he said that they were going to go up about two-thirds of the way between there and Buenos Aires and then scuttle the boat. Well, that would be that Caleta de los Moros. Remember, I told you keep that in mind
Got
on
it.
The map.
Mm-hmm.
And excuse me. And this is an aerial shot of the Caleta de los Loros, and there's two somethings sitting on a bottom, and we'd like to go back there also and dive. The one on the left in the pale water, that's shallow water. Now, some lady, okay, I'll rewind a little bit. Way back in 1994, about 1990, I guess it was, newspaper reports down there said some lady who lives near this Caleta de los Loros said that the remains of a German U-boat that was scuttled could be seen at extremely low tide. So, okay, then in 1995, there was a big whoop-de-doo about a German U-boat being found scuttled in that area. So I called the Argentine Navy, talked to some general. Oh, no, Senor Cooper, all's top secret, top secret. I said, listen, Admiral, there's nothing top secret about a Type 9 German U-boat. I mean, there was nothing secret about that in 1942. It sure isn't secret in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
No, Senor Cooper, all top secret. So I called him again. Excuse me. I called two or three times that week and got the same response. The next week I called him, and I said, General, can you tell me anything about that U-boat? And then I get, what U-boat, Senor Cooper? So it was obvious that road was shut.
Is that the spot we're looking at on the left of this map?
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then,
Go ahead.
Well, okay, so then I just put it on the back burner because I wasn't getting any cooperation.
Sure.
And about the year 2000, I got a call all the way from Buenos Aires from a retiring Argentine Navy officer. And he says, you're the guy looking for that scuttled U-boat, right? And I said, yeah. And he says, it's there. Don't give up on it.
How interesting.
Yeah. So he and I have become good friends. I see him whenever I go down to Buenos Aires. He's a medical doctor, so he's not a line officer. But
got it.
Now to this place, I mean, again, I use that cliche. It's like going to the dark side of the moon. You got to go hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles down a grade B highway, and then dozens and dozens of miles down a dirt road to a place where there ain't a darn thing. You got to truck in everything. You got to bring on all your scuba gear, your tents, you need an ultralight airplane to spot from up above. You need an inflatable. You need a half a dozen or a dozen people.
Uh-huh.
You're talking a serious expedition.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
So that's on the back burner. If we win the lottery, or if Obama sends me the money like he promised to send every American, then we can afford it. But
one-way ticket to hell is what he's promising people.
No argument there. But the other two places we're going for sure, Bariloche and Cordoba. And the food is awesome. The exchange rate, thanks to their economy being more of a free fall than us, the Yankee dollar is really, really powerful. You can get a really good steak dinner with wine, probably $8, $10. Because their peso has dropped.
Right, I understand.
Yeah,
I have a friend down there. Okay, we're going to go back. Pictures, 59, 60, the swimming pool, 61, 62.
Yeah.
Your guess is that this was a point of these people were brought down there. They went here, they stayed, they rested, they enjoyed themselves. They got the new identity. They're processing all their papers and so forth. So this was a transition location. That's your idea.
That's not my guess. That's what our guy down there told us.
Okay. All right.
We got to get down there. I want to take photos myself. I want to take films myself. And I want to go to talk to people. Who owned the place? I want to find that out. Who owned the place? Does he have any descendants, any heirs living in the area? You know, who lived there?
Where was it located again, Harry?
It's in Cordoba province.
Okay. Well,
I forgot the name of the town, but
if it could only talk, was there a large building there? There must have been, which.
Right. Yeah, and I've got photos of that too. But like I say, I didn't post them because they're kind of hard to see. Because the a lot of trees and stuff in the way.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, that looks like a certainly a nice place for a little R&R. How did most of the people who made it from Germany to Argentina transit? Freighters? They didn't do submarines, obviously.
Well, there were a few black boats. One of our members, who's now deceased, on paper, he was a petty officer on board. Incidentally, if the phone goes dead, it's only because we got one tremendous rainstorm going here.
Okay, you're fine.
But he was a petty officer on a destroyer at the end of the war, except Germany didn't have any destroyers at the end of the war.
I was going to ask. All right.
So he finally told me that he had made three trips coming out of Villa Garcia down to, well, he said to the Sargasso Sea, but he was just trying to get me to stop asking him, because he said he made three trips. He was a petty officer, but he was real quick. Boy, he almost jumped out of his chair, but I don't remember who was on my boat. Okay, fair enough. And he spoke flawless English. He spoke British English, because after the war, he and his wife managed hotel chains in England.
Hmm.
So, but they're both passed away now. And my friend Ingrid Scharfenberg, who owned the hotel Zum Turken, which, as I said, was Hitler's, the headquarters for Hitler's personal guard when he was on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
She had a photo that Carl had given her, and he made her promise not to show it to anybody while he was alive. So when I was over to see her last time, he had passed away. She gave me the photo. It's just a photo of him on this boat, but he wasn't supposed to be on that boat. He was supposed to be on a destroyer, which didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of stories that we're just digging them out now, like that Blumenvoss BV-138.
Mm-hmm.
Who did they take out of there? They made mm-hmm. two trips. I got that much so far, but there's more going to come in tomorrow from email.
That's amazing that anyone would have that data at this point. Obviously, they didn't keep logbooks. The war was essentially over, done.
Right.
And that plane was flying in and out, so somebody had firsthand knowledge of that, of those two trips. Now,
right.
That,
this was notes taken by an interrogator in, what was it, I think August of 45 in a hospital in Kiel, because the guy that was telling this story was a sergeant or a petty officer on that flying boat, and he was telling exactly what happened. So I got the first few bits on the email, but there's more coming over the weekend. What I have now so far is in the current issue of the magazine, which is just being proofread and will be emailed out to everybody Sunday. But then in the following issue, there's going to be a bunch more. So if your listeners are interested in joining, they can send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and we can send them a comp issue of the magazine by email. We got thousands of members, and all except 167 of them get it by email. There's 167 diehards who want that hard copy. They tell me, I want paper in my hand. I tell them, well, that's why God put a print button on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I want you to pay for the ink. Okay, fine. So we charge, they pay $15 a year more than the guys that get it electronically. So it's just a nuisance. But, hey, we do what we can for our members. Members get better prices on our DVDs, our books, our tours, the whole nine yards.
Sure. Well, they support the organization.
It's a good bunch of people.
Remarkably unusual.
A lot of great people were members. The four Medal of Honor winning American submarine skippers were members.
Uh-huh.
Plucky, the most highly decorated American submariner ever in history, was in my house. I went to visit him in Annapolis.
Huh.
Otto Kretschmer, the top submarine commander of the war, I had a sleeping room in his house in Emden. I knew Top was in his house, I don't know how many times. Hardigan, the guy who sank the first ship in American waters,
mm-hmm.
he just turned 100 years old last month.
He had his birthday.
Yep, 18th of March, and he's still a member.
Did he get a lot of cards and greetings? You were trying to put that together.
Yeah, and one member even painted a little something on a rock. I don't know what that was all about. But we shipped it. It was a big box we sent over there. And about a week later, I got a call from him, and he's got a distinctive voice, so I knew who it was. Hello, Harry. Hello. Oh, Kevin Hardigan. Yeah. Hello, Harry. I got this box of Christmas birthday cards. He was like a kid with a new toy.
Well, that's very nice.
He's
nice
really
story.
A decent man.
Well, these were times when many people were larger than life in many ways.
You on both sides.
That's right. They don't make them like that anymore. Harry, thank you. Too many times to count for this extraordinary program tonight. We'll make it available for all of your listeners and your members and others who want to hear it as well. So,
excellent.
We'll talk soon.
All right. Good deal. Nice hearing from you, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. That's a program to remember. All right. Enjoy. We'll be back tomorrow.